From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is my death, but this is not my execution. They will take my body, but I believe that I left enough work behind that people will keep on fighting for me, even after I'm dead.
Death row prisoner Kevin Cooper is scheduled to die on February 10th. Today, we'll speak with his lawyer, former Clinton special counsel Lonnie Davis, as well as the legendary Hurricane Carter, who was wrongly imprisoned for almost 20 years. We'll also hear Cooper speaking in his own words from death row. First, Michael Moore called him a deserter. DNC chair Terrence McAuliffe called him AWOL. Why is a year missing in President Bush's military service in the 1970s? We'll talk with the reporter who broke the story 4 years ago. And Professor Noam Chomsky is honored by reporters and correspondents at the United Nations.
Very much appreciated, and now I know how my students feel when they get offered the job.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, May 16th is the day in Massachusetts that gay men and lesbians can legally marry. A state court ruling in Boston has put Massachusetts on a course to become the first state in the country to allow same-sex marriages. The justices ruled that a law to allow gay couples to form civil unions would establish, quote, an unconstitutional, inferior, and discriminatory status for same-sex couples. President Bush condemned the ruling. In a statement, he said, quote, if activist judges insist on redefining marriage by court order, the only alternative will be the constitutional process. We must do what is legally necessary, the president said, to defend the sanctity of marriage. Democratic presidential frontrunner Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts said, quote, I believe the right answer is civil unions. I oppose gay marriage and disagree with the Massachusetts court's decision. In Massachusetts, Republican Governor Mitt Romney called for a state constitutional amendment to define marriage as between a man and a woman. According to the Boston Globe, Massachusetts could join the Canadian provinces of Ontario and British Columbia, Belgium, and the Netherlands as the only governments that offer full civil marriage rights for same-sex couples. New York City Council approved a resolution yesterday condemning the USA Patriot Act. The three largest cities in the country, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, have now all condemned the law that was quickly passed after the September 11th attacks. According to the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, a total of three states and 246 municipalities and counties have passed similar resolutions. Glenn Devitt, an organizer with the committee, said, quote, so much is being done in the name of New York. We're saying don't use our name to infringe on people's rights. The director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, is scheduled to deliver an unusual public defense of the agency in a speech today at Georgetown University. Former U.S. Weapons Inspector David Kay and others have criticized the CIA for miscalculating Iraq's weapons threat. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill Wednesday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told the Senate Armed Services Committee it is too early to determine whether Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. Rumsfeld said, quote, it took us 10 months to find Saddam Hussein. The reality is that the hole he was found in was large enough to hold biological weapons to kill thousands of human beings. And unlike Saddam Hussein, such objects can stay buried. Meanwhile, in Britain, a retired top intelligence official has told the Independent of London that not a single British defense intelligence expert backed Tony Blair's most contentious claims on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Brian Jones, who was the leading expert on such weapons in the Ministry of Defense, said intelligence officers were overruled in their assessments. Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf's cabinet has recommended a presidential pardon for the famed nuclear scientist Abdulkadir Khan, who admitted Wednesday he shared nuclear secrets with Libya, Iran, and North Korea. Khan, who invented Pakistan's nuclear bomb as considered to be a national hero, stunned the country when he confessed on television of leaking nuclear secrets. Khan claimed he'd acted without authorization from the government and begged forgiveness. But other sources in Pakistan say the military and Musharraf knew and backed Khan's dealings with other countries. Mohammed El-Bardeh, the head of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, said Khan's confession was, quote, just the tip of the iceberg for us, and he said Khan was not working alone. One former army chief and ally of Musharraf told The Guardian of London he believed Khan would have been kept out of court because he knows too much. He said, quote, if Khan had appeared in court of law, many things would have come out. That is very dangerous for President Musharraf. Newsweek is reporting the Justice Department has opened up an inquiry into whether Halliburton was involved in the payment of $180 million in possible kickbacks to obtain contracts to build a natural gas plant in Nigeria during a period in the late 1990s when Vice President Dick Cheney was chair of the company. The Securities and Exchange Commission is also conducting its own probe. In Israel, police questioned Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon today about a bribery scandal that might force him from office if he's indicted. A group of British parliamentarians called on the European Union to impose trade sanctions on Israel until it allows the free export of goods from the West Bank and Gaza. According to the MPs, malnutrition rates in Gaza have reached the levels of sub-Saharan Africa. On the campaign trail, the Associated Press is reporting that Wesley Clark's campaign is running out of money. 250 Clark staffers have volunteered to forego pay for a week to help fund ads in Tennessee. And finally, UPI is reporting that nearly one quarter of the detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay are from Saudi Arabia. UPI's survey marks the first time the nationalities of the detainees were closely examined. Of the 650 detainees, about 160 are Saudis. The second and third largest nationality were from Yemen and Pakistan. Afghans are the fourth largest nationality. Other detainees on Guantanamo are from Jordan, Egypt, Morocco, Algeria, Kuwait, China, Turkey, Britain, Tunisia, Russia, France, Bahrain, Australia, Canada, Sudan, Syria, Bangladesh, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mauritania, Qatar, Spain, and Sweden.
Fly Bush to the moon and let him play among the stars. Let him see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, go away. In other words, we won't miss you. You'll be happy out in space. You'll feel the king of all you see. You won't have to deal with people who insist on being free. And when you go, take Cheney and leave the earth safe for peace. You can be our Star Wars spinning high above the earth. You won't be here to see our transformation and rebirth. In other words, hit the road. In other words, don't come back here. Floating out in space, you'll see the earth in all her grace. Perhaps you'll start to grasp the oneness of the human race. Until you do, stay above and leave the earth safe for love.
Peace. Piece de Resistance, singing Flybush to the Moon here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And greetings to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
And we welcome listeners and viewers sending us their compositions, as Piece de Resistance did. You can send them to us at Democracy Now! 87 Lafayette Street, New York, New York, 10013. Yes, we are in New York, where last night the Patriot Act was challenged by the New York City Council, the City Council being becoming one of many in the country that are now saying no to the Patriot Act. It's interesting to once again point out that on December 13th, when U.S. forces captured Saddam Hussein, when the world's headlines were focused on that whole, President George Bush stealthily signed an expansion of the USA Patriot Act. When his staff was questioned about a Saturday signing, which is very unusual, they said, well, he's done it before. Yes, he had done it a year before. Very rare on a Saturday to do a signing. A year before, when it would have meant the government would have been shut down if he didn't sign off on the budget.
Yes, and the City Council of New York actually was poised that following week after the capture of Saddam Hussein to pass the Patriot, to the condemnation of the Patriot Act, but the council members decided that with all the uproar over the capture of Saddam Hussein, they should wait till after the holidays, and apparently they've done it now.
And we will continue to follow this movement around the country that is condemning the Patriot Act.
Well, a 1 year gap in the military service record of President Bush at the Texas Air National Guard during the height of the Vietnam War has come up again in the mainstream media. The issue flared up during the New Hampshire campaign last month when documentary filmmaker Michael Moore referred to Bush as a deserter at a Wesley Clark rally of 1,000 people outside Concord when he described a hypothetical debate between Clark and Bush.
The general versus the deserter. That's the debate. That's the debate we want to see.
This past Sunday, Democratic National Committee Chair Terrence McAuliffe accused Bush of going AWOL or absent without leave while he was serving in the Air National Guard in the early 1970s. In response, Republican National Committee Chair Ed Gillespie accused McAuliffe of leveling a, quote, demonstrably false and malicious charge that would be slanderous under any ordinary circumstance. And Bush campaign spokesperson Terry Holt yesterday accused McAuliffe of trying to, quote, perpetuate a completely false and bogus assertion the president was never AWOL, he said.
The Washington Post picked up the story this week, propelling it even further as a big issue. Yesterday, White House spokesman Scott McClellan was questioned by reporters at a press briefing.
Scott, so. you expressed some outrage this morning that Democrats are questioning whether President Bush shirked his military duty with the Texas Air National Guard. Is the White House trying to come up with any records or any eyewitnesses to demonstrate that he did show up for in Alabama?
Terry, I would just say that it was a shame that this issue was brought up 4 years ago during the campaign, and it is a shame that it is being brought up again. The president fulfilled his duties. The president was honorably discharged.
Scott, can I follow up on that?
Do you have a follow-up?
Well, the question actually was whether or not you're trying to find any eyewitnesses or any records to
Terry, this was addressed 4 years ago, and like I said, it was a shame that it came up then, and it's a shame that some are bringing it up again. Dana, did you have one?
The Democrats have been attacking the president for months on a lot of issues. Why this issue? Why is it that you're choosing to respond to this particular issue where the past...
The reasons I said it is really shameful that this was brought up 4 years ago, and it's shameful that some are trying to bring it up again. I think it is sad to see some stoop to this level, especially so early in an election year. The president, like many Americans, was proud to serve in the National Guard. The National Guard plays an important role in the security of America, and the president was proud of his service.
Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, He says this issue was first raised 4 years ago. Well, the Boston Globe's Walter Robinson produced a meticulously documented report in 2000 showing that President Bush's National Guard records indicate he failed to perform a year of service from 1972 to 1973. We are joined by Walter Robinson, who is editor of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Boston Globe Spotlight team. He's been reporting with the Globe for nearly 30 years. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Amy and Juan.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you just go through President Bush's record in detail back in 1972?
Sure. Let's put bookends on it first. The future president won a slot in the Texas Air National Guard when he finished Yale, largely through the intercession of family friends connected to his father, who was then a congressman in Houston. And he leapfrogged over 500 people to get in. And back then, the National Guard was a refuge for people who did not want to face the draft or serve in Vietnam. Whether that was his motive or not, who knows. But he got in, he went to flight training, and from 1970 to 72, he flew quite regularly. He had a commitment until 1974. And the other end of the bookend, of course, is they let him out early in 73 so he could go to Harvard Business School. But in the middle period, all of a sudden, in April 1972, he stopped flying. He never flew again. And he moved to Alabama that month to work on a Senate campaign. And he was supposed to do his National Guard duty while in Alabama. And there's no record he ever did it. Bush claimed he did. The commander of the unit in Alabama said Bush never showed up. When he returned in early 1973 to Houston, he was supposed to return to his unit in Houston, and he never did. There are four officers at that unit. Two of them were his direct superiors. And on the 1st of May of 1973, they wrote that they could not do his annual efficiency report for the prior 12 months because he had, quote, not been seen at the base in that period. And they presumed that he was doing his training in Alabama, which, of course, he was not. Two other officers who supervised him told us in interviews 4 years ago when we did this story that their assumption was that Bush completed his military obligation in Alabama because they have no recollection of him ever returning to the Houston base. So there is in his formal record, there's no evidence that after early May of 72, he ever did any guard duty. Between May of 72 and September of 73 when he was released, there is some paper in the personnel files of the unit suggesting he may have crammed some drills into the late spring and summer months of 1973 to meet the very minimum requirements before he got out of the service. But the fact of the matter is he was missing for a year. Whether he absent without leave is a serious charge, and it suggests that you essentially left town, didn't show up, and you did it in violation of orders. There's no evidence that Bush was ever charged with that. His superior officer was also a friend of his, and I wouldn't want to speculate on whether they knew that Bush wasn't showing up, but at that period of time in 72 and 73, when U.S. troops were being withdrawn from Vietnam, people who had taken refuge in the Guard, in many instances, there wasn't a lot of attention to fulfilling the requirements of the Guard. Bush, early in the campaign for president, as you know, made comments like, when I was young and foolish, I was young and foolish. And I mean, quite clearly, there's a period of his life before he went to business school that he's not proud of. All of this, as you pointed out, was reported 4 years ago. And received a remarkably little attention at that time.
Well, of course, I guess part of the problem was that in the middle of a presidential race against Al Gore, who himself did not exactly have a sterling military record. I think he worked as a reporter for the military newspaper for a time, that it seems like unlikely that Al Gore was going to raise the issue. But obviously, in this context,
Gore, as we've gone back over this issue in this morning's Globe, which. I sound like a presidential candidate here. It can be seen at www.boston.com. One issue that Gore faced was that he himself, as you note, had credibility issues. And one of them was that Gore, who had in fact served in Vietnam, had claimed at one point falsely that he had come under fire. And that was part of the public record in 2000. And so Gore was not exactly in the kind of position where he could have challenged Bush on this issue back then.
Now, has Bush himself ever responded or explained where he was in that?
No, there have been a number of explanations by him and by his principal spokesman on the issue, Dan Bartlett, and some of them are at odds with one another. For instance, after he went to Alabama, he was removed from flight status because he hadn't taken his annual flight physical. And Mr. Bartlett said, well, that's because his doctor was in Houston and he was in Alabama. The fact is, flight physicals are given by Air Force doctors, and there were Air Force doctors in Alabama who could have done that. When Bartlett initially said, speaking for Bush, that Bush had in fact showed up at the Alabama Guard unit, we contacted the officers who ran it, and they said, no way. And then Bartlett said, well, then he went back there later and did the drills. So Bush's memory is, well, I did my duty in Alabama, and after I returned to Houston, I did some duty, but I don't remember what it was or who I worked for. And neither in Alabama nor Texas has any serviceman who was at either base come forward, which is remarkable given the resources of the Bush administration, ever come forward to say, to testify, yes, that he in fact was present for duty during this missing year.
We're talking to Walter Robinson, who is the reporter who broke the story with the Boston Globe 4 years ago about Bush's record 1972-1973 in the Texas National Guard. At the time, during that period, the issue, well, then, of course, he wasn't a public figure, not very much raised, but then you have the election 2000. Now it looks like the question is, how will the press deal with this issue? There's an interesting piece in the New Republic that says what Jennings taught Clark last week is that the media probably won't tolerate it. And that is the question of calling Bush a deserter or having gone AWOL. Can you talk about that, how this question the Republicans are attempting to pummel the media into marginalizing that?
Well, I don't cover presidential politics anymore, thank God. But I, speaking as a journalist, what we have here, almost 200 pages of very complex military records. Very few reporters have them or have looked at them. Some who have them and have looked at them have misinterpreted them. Most reporters who are dealing with this issue are covering the campaign and dealing with a whole lot of issues every day. And so they're essentially dependent upon what the Democratic National Committee says on the one hand and what the White House says on the other hand. So it's sort of, there's a lot of fog around this issue, and it's really being generated by both sides. I mean, it's to call Bush a deserter is I think looking at the facts, to grossly overstate what happened. I mean, you had a fellow in a guard unit who was connected, who got in because of his connections, who was friendly with his commander, who apparently lost interest in the guard duty during that period of time, and he was allowed to take a slide. And so he didn't fulfill the military commitment, which by itself, in the view of many veterans, was a kind of a way to duck the draft. And, I mean, that's the issue. And the question is whether, if, for instance, the Democratic nominee is Senator John Kerry, who has a much more meritorious military record during that period for his Vietnam service, say, than Al Gore did. The question is whether this issue matters, whether it's perhaps it's a subliminal issue for people who are weighing the credibility of the incumbent president on more issues that are more important to them, like why we went to war and that sort of thing. And I think the Democrats see it as an issue that they can exploit. And quite clearly from the reaction from the White House is, to put it mildly, a little bit concerned about this issue gaining traction.
And I think, well, as you say, especially for people who are not familiar with the military and are not familiar with the times during the Vietnam War, when clearly the military was having all kinds of problems with its troops, that it's very possible for basically a person to, in essence, be given a slide and have, in essence, a no-show job, more than an AWOL, because, as you say, you've got to have been absent despite orders to be at a particular place to be AWOL, but for you to have a no-show job for a period of time, which seems like what occurred here, was actually pretty prevalent in those times. The problem becomes, does the president honestly answer, you know, what was he doing and own up to whatever his negligence was in this particular case?
I mean, they're not going to do that. You know, when Bush was governor and when he was running for president, they had on his biography that he was a pilot with the Texas Air National Guard from 1968 to 1973. First of all, he didn't finish his pilot training until late 69. But he only flew for about 2 years, and then he stopped flying. And so after this story appeared in 2000, they sort of fuzzed up the wording on the campaign website, just saying he had been a pilot for the Texas Guard. They left the years out. I don't think there's, from the way the White House has reacted to this, you know, their point is he got an honorable discharge. He remembers serving. The records are inexplicable. You know, it's not an issue that they want to give any life to, and you know, understandably, I mean, it's for them to admit now that what the records make pretty obvious would cause more political damage to them probably than the continued denials.
Walter Robinson, I want to thank you for being with us. Walter Robinson, reporter with the Boston Globe, broke the story of Bush's record in the National Guard in 1972, broke it 4 years ago. You are listening to Democracy Now! He has a recap piece in today's Boston Globe, which makes four major points, saying, again, according to the records and interviews in 2000, Bush's attendance record in the Guard was highly unusual, saying, one, although he was trained as a fighter pilot, Bush ceased flying in April 72, little more than 2 years after he finished flight school and 2 years before his six-year enlistment was to end, when he was allowed to transfer to an Alabama Guard unit. The records contain no evidence that Bush performed any military duty in Alabama. His Alabama unit commander in an interview said Bush never appeared for duty. Two, in August 72, Bush was suspended from flight status for failing to take his annual flight physical. Three, in May 73, Bush's two superior officers in Houston wrote they could not perform his annual evaluation because he had, quote, not been observed at this unit during the preceding 12 months. The two officers, one of them a friend of Bush and both now dead, wrote they believe Bush had been fulfilling his commitment at the Alabama unit. That in today's Boston Globe. You are listening to Democracy Now! Later in the program, we'll hear a prisoner on death row and his defense by a man who is known around the world for having been wrongly imprisoned for more than for close to 20 years, Hurricane Carter. We'll also hear from Clinton's special counsel, who's now Kevin Cooper's lawyer, the man on death row. But first, Noam Chomsky, stay with us.
You play with her and then you throw it away. Why do you use me? Play to confuse me. How can you stand to be so cruel? Why don't you free me from this prison? For serve my time as a fool. It's a shame the way you mess around with the man. It's a shame.
It's a shame. The Spinners here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the famed linguist and political analyst and activist, Professor Noam Chomsky. On Tuesday, the president of the United Nations Society of Writers and Artists, Hans Janáček, presented Noam Chomsky with the Award of Excellence at the UN Correspondents Association Club in the United Nations in New York.
Professor Chomsky, it's a great honor for us that you accepted our invitation, but even more so that you accepted our Award of Excellence, which the Society of Writers has been giving annually to outstanding literary and political figures for their contribution to peace and understanding. In fact, over the past 15 or 17 years so far, and it was previously awarded to international statesmen such as Mikhail S. Gorbachev and great writers like Norman Mailer. The members of the society, founded in 1989, are diplomats and journalists accredited to the United Nations as well as individual staff members with a distinguished literary record. We deeply believe that there is a link between politics or diplomacy on one hand and literary art on the other, because there are many things that you cannot say in a political or diplomatic fashion. You need a literary element. And this is one of the things that we have admired about you for so many years. It's not only what you say, it's how you say it. And you can see what a response you have. And you never raise your voice. And you never swear. And you never hit the table with your fist. You always keep calm, but persuasive. Persuasive indeed. And this is why the citation for the award, which is a medal, I will show it, which is a medal on a blue ribbon with the inscription Ex Mente Orbis, which I would translate as from the spirit of the world. But there are also other interpretations, but what it means really is the conscience of mankind, and that's what it's all about. Professor Chomsky, we honor you today in gratitude. You have kept the flame of reason and common sense alive when they were threatened. You stayed calm in the clash of civilizations, but recorded the conflict in a uniquely somber and persuasive style. Your voice is heard all over the globe. You have earned the respect of millions eager to find the truth in a troubled world. there is no better place to express our respect to you than here at the United Nations, whose spirit and principles you represent.
That was Hans Janáček, presenting Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, with the Award of Excellence at the United Nations Correspondents Association Club in New York. Noam Chomsky is an institute professor and professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's the author of Hegemony or Survival, America. Hegemony or Survival, America, Quest for the Global Dominance, 9-1-1, Power and Terror, and many other books. After the award ceremony, Chomsky addressed a large crowd at the United Nations talking about U.S. hegemony, Iraq, space travel, and many more subjects. He then took questions from reporters.
Hi, Mr. Chomsky. Ricardo Dive from Notimex. I want to ask you two brief questions. What is, in your view, the risk of four more years of Bush, both inside the United States and for the international system, what the impact will be? And secondly, do you think Kofi Annan should cede to U.S. pressure to send back human personnel to Iraq? And does he have any room not to say, I mean, to say no?
Thank you.
It's very hard to predict the weather, and predicting human affairs is extremely difficult. But there is a fair possibility, you know, a possibility beyond what I think any rational person would want to accept, that another 4 years of the same policies, it could be extremely dangerous for the country and the world, and could cause maybe irreparable harm. Remember, we have a lot of evidence. It's not just the past 4 years. The same people essentially were in office for 12 years, 1981 to 1992, and there is a rich record of what they accomplished. It is not discussed in the United States because we have a kind of a principle here that you're not supposed to look into the mirror. It's not unique to the United States, but very striking here. So anything that happened in the past didn't happen, okay, because we've changed course or some miracle has taken place. So we're therefore not permitted to carry out the rational approach that we would to anyone else. I mean, if Saddam Hussein appears in a trial and says, well, why are you bringing up all that old stuff from the 80s? It doesn't mean anything now. I'm a nice guy. I just had a born-again experience, and you know, I'm going right to heaven. We wouldn't even bother laughing. But when that is done year after year after year, as it is, by our own leaders, we applaud. Okay, that's what it means to be a disciplined intellectual. And if we don't want to accept that discipline, we can treat the matter just as we would in the case of Saddam's crimes or Stalin's crimes or anyone else's. We can ask, well, what did they do during those 12 years and what have they been doing the last 4 years, the more reactionary. It's a reactionary selection from the first 12 years. And it's clear enough. They have a domestic agenda, which is not hidden. I mean, they're trying to unravel the progressive legislation of the past century to overcome the achievements of popular struggles, hard ones, to gain some benefits for people, what we call a minimal welfare state, to transfer power into the hands of unaccountable private tyrannies in one way or another. Every aspect of the program is like that. Internationally, they have the programs that I've described. They may back off from them because they may find them unfeasible, but the programs are clear, and that's only part of them. I mean, there's also programs about international economic arrangements. I think these could be very dangerous. In fact, the kinds of programs I just talked about could literally lead to destruction of the species. You know, again, you can't put a probability on that. We don't know what the likelihood was of a devastating nuclear war in 1962, right? When literally the world was one word away from a nuclear exchange. one Russian submarine commander countermanded an order to shoot off nuclear-tipped torpedoes during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which very likely would have led to a devastating nuclear response, and then on and on, and then Eisenhower's destruction of the Northern Hemisphere. One word. That was 1962. January 1959, 1995 was much more dangerous, far greater destructive capacity. At that point, we were 2 minutes away. As these threats are being increased, militarization of space alone is increasing the threat significantly. Rational people don't take chances like that, and no matter what your subjective probability is, but it will increase.
Financial Times.
Sorry, on the Kofi Annan, you're
right. Oh. Well, you know, basically no one has a right to be in Iraq but Iraqis, so they should take the lead in determining what happens. What the invasion has left such wreckage that how Iraqis might decide to deal with what remains, you know, I can't say. I mean, we know what they say in polls, and you can make your own judgments from that. In recent Iraqi polls, the most favorable rating for a foreign leader is Jacques Chirac. By about five to one, they regard the U.S.-British forces as occupiers, not liberators. Right after Bush made his speech about how we're changing course once again and going to bring democracy to the world, actually reiterating what Reagan had said 20 years earlier and everyone else, after that speech, which was greeted with the usual reverential awe in the United States, there was a poll in Iraq about asking, you know, Iraqis why they thought the U.S. was in Iraq, and some agreed with President Bush and the commentators here. 1%. 1% thought that the goal was to bring democracy to Iraq. About 70% thought it was to control Iraq's resources and to reorder the Middle East and consistently with the goals of the United States and Israel. Actually, their responses were more nuanced and sophisticated. When it went further, it turned out that about half, although 1% thought the U.S. was trying to bring democracy, about half thought that the United States wanted democracy if the U.S. could control it. Now, that's the sophisticated response, the one that's based on history, the one that is understood by everyone in Latin America, for example.
Noam Chomsky speaking this week at the United Nations after he was awarded the Award of Excellence by the United Nations Society of Writers and Artists. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
I bet there's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me.
Pick it one more time, Willie. One more chance.
This is Democracy Now!, and that was Johnny Cash. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Outside the gates of San Quentin Prison in California, four activists were arrested Tuesday. There were rallies around the state protesting the scheduled execution of Kevin Cooper. They're calling for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to reconsider his decision last week to deny clemency to Cooper. Cooper was convicted of a quadruple homicide in 1983, but he's long maintained his innocence. He's scheduled to die by lethal injection just after midnight next Tuesday.
Full-page advertisements also appeared in California newspapers asking, quote, does the state of California have the wrong man? It was signed by dozens of members of the California legislature, including Senate President Pro Tem John Burton, Democrat of San Francisco. Also signed the letter was Lanny Davis. He is the former special counsel to President Bill Clinton and a member of Cooper's defense team. He joins us on the program today.
We're also joined by Reuben Hurricane Carter, the executive director of the International Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted. In the 60s, Carter was a prize fighter. He had a promising boxing career, which was cut short when he was wrongly convicted of a multiple murder, sentenced to three consecutive life sentences. He spent almost two decades in prison before he was finally exonerated. We're going to start with Lanny Davis, the attorney for Kevin Cooper, the former special counsel to President Clinton. Can you give us the details of Kevin Cooper's case and why you have signed on to it, why you're representing him?
Yes, first of all, I'm honored to be on any program with Reuben Carter, who exemplifies the courage of someone who was an innocent man, twice convicted, and ultimately vindicated because of corrupted police evidence and testimony, which is why it is relevant to talk about Kevin Cooper. I only want to talk about undisputed facts and leave your listeners to answer the question, why would we kill a man with these undisputed facts never heard by the jury? Let me repeat. I'm going to give you three undisputed facts, not facts that are in dispute between the government and the defense. Three undisputed facts never heard by the jury. Fact one, a little girl who was murdered on the scene was found clutching over 100 blonde human hairs. Kevin Cooper doesn't have a human hair anywhere. He's an African American. That evidence was never tested, and the evidence was never heard by the jury, even though the prosecutor said this entire case rests on the assumption that only one man, killed these four people in under 2 minutes with three murder weapons.
So you're saying that Kevin Cooper doesn't have a blonde hair?
He has not a blonde hair. That evidence was never heard by the jury, and the hair was never tested. Fact two, a girlfriend of a man who had come home the night of the murders with bloody coveralls testified that he was acting suspiciously and in panic. He took the bloody coveralls off, and his axe from his tool belt was missing. This was testified to under oath by a detective that that's what this woman told him. Those coveralls disappeared 2 weeks later, and that evidence was never heard by the jury. Fact three, a gentleman by the name, if I can call him gentleman, Kevin Kuhn, who was a friend of this individual with the bloody coveralls, several months later in prison confessed to his cellmate that he was involved with this Mr. Furrow, the bloody coveralls man, in the murder in the Ryan household, and he described details of the Ryan household that he could not have known had he not been there. That confession was never heard by the jury, and indeed a judge on the Ninth Circuit said, never in my memory have we ever executed anyone where we had a confession to the murder without having that confession heard as evidence at trial. So for those three reasons alone, it is absolutely incomprehensible that Governor Schwarzenegger not only denied our petition for clemency so we could air that evidence, but he never addressed a single one of those undisputed facts in his denial statement. He ignored totally those three facts, and that is to us unfair and suggests that he perhaps did not even read the letter that we wrote to him.
We're also joined by Reuben Hurricane Carter, who has become involved in the case. Can you tell us a little bit why you got involved and how the opposition to the execution has been building?
Yes. Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much, Lani. You are very kind. You're very kind. You gave three reasons, Lani. There's two more that is very important. One is the fact that every elected official in the United States of America is sworn into office by swearing to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. Now, that's so help me God. That's an oath that all elected officials take, including Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Terminator. And the question, the threshold question, constitutional question that we are confronting here today is, would all of this evidence that Lonnie just told us, and much more, would this evidence have changed the verdict of the jury had it been presented to the jury? And we have six jurors who have signed affidavits to Governor Schwarzenegger saying that had they had the evidence that Lanny just told you about and other evidence, that their decision would have been different on both aspects of the case, on the guilt aspect of it as well as the punishment phase of it. Now, that's the key here. The constitutional guarantee that every person accused of a crime is given a full and fair hearing in front of a jury of their peers. Kevin Cooper did not have that constitutional guaranteed honored. And therefore, it is quite barbaric for the United States now to execute a person who may very well be innocent without that person having the having the benefit of his due processes and constitutional guarantees. The fourth, or rather the fifth reason why Kevin Cooper should not be executed is because there's this execution, this death penalty, is symptomatic of a much larger problem than we are confronting here. You see, every civilization, every society rises and falls upon two definite lines of development, the line of construction and the line of destruction. Well, the line of construction is where we build our homes, our businesses, our commerce, our libraries, our all of that good stuff. And the moment we begin to value that line of construction, immediately the line of destruction begins to appear because we want to protect what we have, our line of construction. And as long as these lines of development proceed side by side, one helping one another, that society will flourish. But if the line of construction gets too far ahead of the line of destruction, you got a weak society.
Let me ask Lonnie Davis a question, attorney for Kevin Cooper. The question is why this is all coming up so late. There was a child who survived the multiple homicide. What did that child say that...
May I answer this one, Reuben? This is the part that troubles me maybe more than anything in the case. The child, God bless him that he survived, was taken to the hospital with a slit throat and with all sorts of stab wounds. And during the first interviews with police while he was in his hospital bed, he was asked, do you recall who killed everybody in the house? His first answer was there were three men. They were either white or they were Mexican-American. When he recovered the next day, he said the same thing to his nurses and to his grandmother. And then subsequently, when he was fully recovered and was interviewed by his psychiatrist, he repeated the same thing. There were three men, which does sound plausible given the fact that four people were allegedly murdered, and we know that they were murdered in under 2 minutes. Then when Kevin Cooper was apprehended a month later and his photograph was shown on television, in the witnessed by nurses and his grandmother, young Josh Ryan looked at the television screen and in front of everyone said, "That's not the man." Now, that is undisputed, what I just said to you. The only dispute is when it came to trial months later, after Josh Ryan had spent a good deal of time with police, including living at the home of a detective for a while, he ended up changing his story by saying, "I didn't really see three men, I saw a shadow." Now, with all due respect to this young man, I can understand how his mind can be shaped and influenced in the situation that he was in. But there is no dispute that he identified three people over and over again before he changed his story at trial.
Let me ask Lonnie Davis another issue, because obviously DNA has often been used to absolve people who have been convicted of crimes. But in this case, the DNA test that was done identified blood in the house as belonging to the defendant. Could you talk about that?
Yes, let me talk, Lonnie.
Or Ruben, yes, Ruben, yes, Hurricane Carter.
I'm sorry for cutting in here. Yes. Josh Ryan, from the very moment that the crime took place, said that Kevin Cooper was not the person. This went on for a good while. But when Kevin Cooper demanded DNA testing, and there was two spots in which his blood was determined to have been in the house, that's one of the, and also which changed Josh Ryan's mind, whereby he thinks today that Kevin Cooper is guilty only because of this DNA test. You see, that is one of the questions that we that is very much in contention here. Those two spots of blood that tested positive for Kevin Cooper's blood is very much in question. We think that blood has been put there. We are asking for a EDTA test on those two spots, which will determine whether there is preservatives in that blood or not. If there are preservatives in that blood, then it means that that blood did not come from the body of Kevin Cooper. It came from a test tube. And that's what we need to determine before we take this person's life.
We're going to end with the words of Kevin Cooper from prison. He was interviewed by KPFA Flashpoints producer Leslie Kane. We're just going to hear a minute of what he has to say.
We have now, I think, 15 women down here in Chowchilla Prison on death row. Not too long ago, it was one. Pretty soon, they'll be talking about, for the first time since such and such a date, such and such a time, we're getting ready to execute a woman. But that's how women are getting their equal rights now. They don't get equal pay for equal work. No, they don't get the equal rights when they pass. There's a whole lot of things they don't get. But when it comes to the death penalty, they get that equally. I mean, so this thing that they do to us poor people is across the board, no matter what we are, what religion we are. And if we're different than them, we got this coming. And this is the knowledge that I have as I face my death. You know, yeah, this is my death, but this is not my execution. They will take my body. But I believe that I left enough work behind that people will keep on fighting for me, even after I'm dead.
The words of Kevin Cooper on death row in San Quentin. Ruben Carter, last comment.
May I break some news here that is about to break, and the AP has the story this morning. We have had suspicions that this blood has been planted by the police for some time. And one of the reasons that I grew suspicious is there's literally no reason not to do the EDTA test. It costs under $1,000. It takes less than 2 weeks. It would establish where the blood came out of the test tube, where there was a sample of Kevin Cooper's blood that had been held for some time, or versus whether there was actually blood on the crime scene in a tiny little
spot. We have 5 seconds.
Yes, we ask everyone.
Well, my 5 seconds are, why won't the government do that test? Is anyone listening? Can anyone answer the question, why are they refusing to do the test?
Ruben Carter, last comment.
Yes, we would like to have everybody, every person in the United States of America and even in the world, to call the governor at area code 916-445-2840 or email the governor at governor@dotca.governor.
On that note, we have to end the show, and I thank you both for being with us, Ruben Carter and Lonnie Davis. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez.